Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. When your doctor prescribes an FDA-approved medication, are you confident that the drug will help you, or at the very least, that it won't hurt you? And when you are told a drug has been clinically tested, can you be certain the published results reflect everything researchers learned about its effects? Allison Bass began her investigation into these subjects when, as a reporter for the Boston Globe, she received a tip from a reader who said her boss was receiving state money for psychiatric research that was not being conducted. Later, Bass followed the effects of other crusaders, followed the efforts, rather, of other crusaders to ensure that consumers have access to true information about the drugs marketed to them and their doctors. Her new book is called Side Effects, A Prosecutor, a Whistleblower, and a Best-Selling Antidepressant on Trial. Allison, welcome to Think.
It's good to be with you.
So we should start with this, I guess, the basics. How is testing structured for new drugs, whether antidepressants or anything else, before they are approved by the FDA?
Well, basically, the testing is done sponsored by the drug companies who fund research, often at academic centers and sometimes at private research organizations. And they have to do, first, they have to do toxicity and safety testing in animals, and then only then can they do clinical trials in human beings to see if the drug is more effective than, say, a sugar pill or placebo.
Now, the FDA is sort of overseeing this process, but there's also sort of a direct tie to them and drug manufacturers with regard to money.
Well, that's correct. In 1993, Congress passed the Prescription Drug User Fee Act, which would enable drug companies to give money to the FDA to speed up drug approvals and reviews. And they did this because basically during the Reagan administration and the first Bush administration, the resources that the FDA were severely cut, and FDA needed to make up the money somehow. But in 93, the percentage of industry allocation for the FDA drug approval budget was just 7%. It's currently more than half all of the FDA's entire drug review budget, and some consumer advocates believe that that makes the FDA beholden to the very industry it's supposed to regulate.
Now, the lobby for the pharmaceutical industry, and it is an enormous one, we'll get to talking about that in a little while, would argue that yes, this process may now fund a great deal of the FDA's oversight. However, it also allows people who are very sick with a variety of different problems to get medication that could save their lives sooner.
Well, I really think that more money needs to go into the FDA so they can have regulatory oversight of drug testing. Other people like Dr. Marcia Angel and other experts have called for more funding, independent funding of drug testing, because the drug companies have a vested interest in achieving positive findings, and unfortunately that has led to the skewing of scientific research in some cases, such as the case I talk about in my book.
Yeah, the drug that is at the core of your story is Paxil, which was among a similar crop of medications called selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors that were touted essentially as miracle drugs for people who had depression.
That's right. They were approved by the FDA starting in the late 80s and early 90s for the treatment of depression in adults. However, they became widely prescribed for off-label, what we call off-label uses, conditions not approved by the FDA, because they were heavily marketed for those other conditions, such as use in children and adolescents. And so the drug companies also did a number of clinical trials for those other uses and the use of these antidepressants in children and adolescents, and they withheld negative findings about these drugs in children and adolescents, and only published a few positive ones.
How is that possible, that a drug company can conduct this research and realize in no uncertain terms that in this case there was a greater suicide risk for children and teenagers who took Paxil? How are they able to not disclose everything?
Well, they are not required to by the federal government or by medical journals. So what happens is that they only publish the positive findings in medical journals and at conferences, which is where doctors get their information to know how to prescribe and what drugs to prescribe. While the data does have to go to the FDA, the FDA doesn't require them to disclose it to the public, either physicians or consumers.
And even the published results didn't find that there was much effectiveness for this drug.
Well, that's correct. I mean, unfortunately, there was one study that purported to show that Paxil was more effective than a placebo for treating depression in adolescents, but actually the data didn't support the findings. And even despite that, and that's actually why the study was not published in some of the leading medical journals. It was finally published in a psychiatric journal, and it turns out that the FDA itself said this is actually a negative finding, even though it was published when it was published in the journal in 2001, it purported to show a positive finding. And as a result, a lot of doctors began prescribing Paxil for children and adolescents, so it was very misleading to the public.
Meanwhile, around sort of the turn of the century, these drugs had become so common for use in children that they were prescribed more commonly than things like acne medications and eye drops.
Well, that's correct. You have to understand that the antidepressants, this class of SSRI antidepressants, were considered, they were marketed as a very clean, safe drug with allegedly few side effects, and that simply wasn't true, but the drug companies were allowed to market that as such, and basically they sold a bill of goods to a lot of doctors who prescribed them for children and adolescents. And that there was also a lot of pressure with managed care at the time for doctors to come up with a quick fix to deal with depression and other problems that children and adolescents presented with. So instead of trying to get the whole family into therapy for family therapy or cognitive behavioral therapy or psychotherapy, pediatricians and primary care physicians just handed out the pills. And because they didn't know then that there was this increased risk of suicidal thoughts and behaviors in some children and adolescents, they didn't know to monitor them. And as a result, a number of children and adolescents killed themselves or tried to.
Yeah, and you mentioned, you know, primary care physicians and pediatricians, because they are, in fact, they tend to be prescribed more often by sort of general practice physicians as opposed to psychiatrists.
Well, psychiatrists also prescribe them often, but the problem is that psychiatrists, because of their training, do tend to monitor the patients more closely. They usually have a long-term relationship, and they so generally, I mean, I don't want to make generalizations, and that there are some fantastic pediatricians and primary care physicians who also monitor their patients very closely. But a lot of the problems occurred because these drugs were being given out too readily and were not the patients were not being monitored for the increased agitation or suicidal thoughts and behaviors that some patients developed while taking the drug.
Journalist Allison Bass is my guest. Her new book is called Side Effects, A Prosecutor, a Whistleblower, and a Best-Selling Antidepressant on Trial. So let's go back to this time. You were covering mental health for the Boston Globe, and you had sort of a tip phone call that you returned.
That's right. An anonymous woman called the Boston Globe City Desk and left a message, something to do with the misappropriation of funding from the state mental health agency, and because I was the mental health reporter for the Globe at the time, I returned the call. And the woman identified herself as Donna Howard, who was an assistant research administrator at Brown University's School of Medicine. And she said she had in her possession evidence that the psychiatry department, was collecting hundreds of thousands of dollars from the state mental health agency for research that apparently wasn't being conducted. She also said that she had evidence that there was the misrepresentation of data in two clinical trials, one of which was on Paxil in adolescents. And I just couldn't, you know, I remember typing very quickly, my phone cradled to one ear, thinking this can't be for real. But I met her the next day, and she had the documents in her possession, and everything she said checked out. So I wrote a series of articles then. But not about Paxil. It was mostly about the misappropriation of funding. I wasn't able to pin down the Paxil allegations until the New York Attorney General's office sued GlaxoSmithKline, the maker of Paxil, and it turns out that they had looked into the same study and found discrepancies.
Yeah, there had been. It was not as if there wasn't plenty of evidence that there were serious problems with this drug.
Well, that's correct. I mean, even starting back in the early 90s with the very first SSRI, Prozac, there was evidence of increased suicidal thoughts and behaviors in people taking Prozac. And that was a doctor at Harvard Medical School, Dr. Marty Teicher, was one of the first to publish case findings showing this severe side effect. But basically, the FDA swept it under the rug. and dismissed the findings. And it wasn't until 14 years later that the FDA finally put black box warnings on all of these SSRI antidepressants, warning about the increased risk of suicidal thoughts and behaviors in children and young adults.
Marty Teicher is such an interesting character because he was sort of making this outcry against SSRIs at a time when everyone thought he was crazy for saying so.
That's right. In fact, he remembers being at a conference where one of his colleagues, he overheard somebody say, well, there's the Scientologist from Massachusetts. And, of course, he was a professor at Harvard Medical School, very respected and continues to be a very respected researcher. And he just had come across this evidence and had published this finding with his colleagues at McLean Hospital, and he believed in speaking up about it. He continues to prescribe antidepressants. That's not the issue. I mean, these drugs do work for many people, and they do lift the fog of depression and ease anxiety for many people. All he wanted was doctors and the public to know that there were these side effects in some people so they could be monitored and be aware if that happened to them.
Can you talk, Allison, one would assume that drug companies would want to make sure that maybe in the fine print they published any negative findings to protect themselves from lawsuits later on, from people who said you had this information, you didn't share it, and therefore you are responsible for any damage done to us.
Well, unfortunately, they are getting sued now. GlaxoSmithKline, Eli Lilly, all of them are being sued because they withheld the negative findings. The business model of drug companies is to come up with a drug that works and then try to make it into a blockbuster drug with enormous sales by basically getting it overprescribed, prescribed for use in patients that really don't need it. And that's where you often see a lot of the side effects. So their business model is to make a lot of money, and unfortunately, all they did withhold negative findings, and it's not just with the antidepressants. It happened with the antipsychotics like Zyprexa. It happened with Vioxx, and it's continuing to happen with some anti-anemia drugs, Procrit and Aranesp. Again and again, there is evidence that the drug companies knew of an increased risk, and they did not publish that information in respected medical journals, and they did not disclose that to doctors and consumers.
Can you talk about how drug companies identify and then court people that they consider to be opinion leaders in the medical profession who might help them promote their products in a sort of indirect way?
Sure. The drug companies call them key opinion leaders or COLs, and these are prominent doctors, in this case psychiatrists, who are chief of psychiatry at Brown University, who was Donna Howard's boss and who I wrote about in the 90s, and other people who their colleagues look up to, and they pay them in Dr. Keller's case, hundreds of thousands of dollars in consulting and speaking fees. And in that way, and these are the same doctors that are doing research on the very drugs that these companies make. So these are blatant conflicts of interest. And just recently, for instance, the New York Times wrote about three other doctors, psychiatrists at Harvard Medical School, who were among the fiercest proponents of using very powerful psychoactive drugs, antipsychotics, to treat childhood bipolar disorder in children as young as 3 and 4. And it turns out that these psychiatrists were also earning millions of dollars from the very companies whose drugs they were touting.
Allison Bass is my guest. Her new book is called Side Effects, A Prosecutor, a Whistleblower, and a Best-Selling Antidepressant on Trial. You're welcome to join us. The telephone number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, a way to keep your greatest two tools, imagination and curiosity, sharp.
You're listening listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with journalist Allison Bass. Her new book is called Side Effects, A Prosecutor, a Whistleblower, and a Best-Selling Antidepressant on Trial. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send an email to think@kera.org. So you mentioned earlier, Allison, that there are now black box warnings, which are specific drug warnings on the labels of Paxil and most other similar medications. Have they affected the rate at which these drugs are being prescribed to children and teenagers and adults, for that matter?
Well, they have. The prescriptions for children and adolescents have dropped slightly. However, these drugs are still among the top five classes of drugs sold in the United States today, so they are still very widely prescribed.
And what changes in terms of the follow-up for a patient who still chooses to take a black-boxed medication?
Well, I think that they need to be aware of the possibility of these side effects, and they need to make their doctors aware. In fact, any doctor that prescribes the drug without warning the patient or the family of the patient that these suicidal thoughts and behaviors could occur is really not doing his or her job. So they need to, and unfortunately it still happens. I mean, I heard recently from a reader who started taking Paxil and then another antidepressant last year, and she was not told about the side effects and started feeling agitated and suicidal. But because she was aware of the side effects from my research, she weaned herself off the drug. But so this is still happening, unfortunately.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is Allison Bass. Her new book is called Side Effects. Let's speak to Syed in Richardson. Hi, Syed.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks.
Great program.
Thanks.
I just wanted to comment that I myself am a practitioner of alternative medicine. I see a number of patients related to depression and other stress-related disorders. I was wondering if the guest could comment on the fact that, you know, not just the side effects of these medicines, but the fact that many researchers contend that whether antidepressants and anxiety drugs are really...
You know, let me interrupt you for a second because you're getting we're getting wind noise or something. Can you repeat your question again? That's okay.
Yeah, I was saying that I was wondering if the guest could comment on not just the side effects of the drugs, but the fact that a number of researchers have pointed out that many of these drugs do not really either fix or treat these problems. They're basically just masking the symptoms while you take them. And in fact, a number of researchers and even medical doctors have pointed out that with respect to depression and anxiety, chemical imbalance itself has not really been truly proven to be a cause. There are a number of people who say that it's rather an effect rather than a cause. And so while you're taking these things, they can mask symptoms, but rarely do they ever treat as evidenced by the fact that when you quit them, you know, people have really bad withdrawal symptoms.
Well, that's a very good question. What I think you're alluding to is that the fact that the clinical trials that the drug companies themselves did showed that these antidepressants, these SSRI antidepressants, are no more effective than a placebo in treating depression in children and adolescents. So the clinical trials themselves don't show efficacy for that age group. They do show some efficacy in older adults. However, that has been questioned. And the reason why it's been questioned is because there's this something called a placebo effect in people with mental illness. And the placebo effect is such that if people believe, when these studies are done, patients are usually randomized to one of two groups. One goes to the active drug and one goes to the placebo, and they don't know which group they're in. So they may think they're getting the active drug and that they get better because of that. That is what's called the placebo effect. And there is an astonishingly high placebo effect in these studies. In other words, just by virtue of giving someone with depression or anxiety medication, they feel better. That's what we call the placebo effect. So you're right in the fact that placebo effect is very high. However, there are clinical trials that show that for older adults, these antidepressants are more effective than placebo. But as you said, these studies are coming under question.
And, you know, we talked about children being prescribed this medication off-label before it was ever tested. In fact, most drugs of this nature are prescribed to children before they've ever been actually given to a child in a clinical setting where they can be studied.
That's correct. What happens is doctors see that the drugs work for adults, so they make the supposition that, oh, well, they'll work for children and adolescents. But the minds of and the bodies of children and adolescents are very different from adults. They're growing, and that is not a good supposition. However, when, you know, parents come in and they're very upset, their child is depressed or anxious or not functioning at school, and they want a quick fix. And many doctors say, okay, well, this drug is approved for use in adults. Let's try it out.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can send email to think@kera.org. Let's go next to Lisa in Dallas. Hi, Lisa.
Hi. Yes, I wanted to comment here. I'm a little concerned. I appreciate the intent of the book and the study. I'm just reading a piece in the New York Times and an opinion page from Dick Cavett, who has suffered from depression. He summarizes a lot of the concerns that people with depression have. And I can say from personal experience, I have taken SSRIs for more than 20 years, and various members of my family, I have discovered, have also come to them through their physicians. The biggest problem that people with emotional illness have is that there's still a very strong prejudice. Your previous caller mentioned it. There's the belief that it's not a medical problem, that these people just need to get over it, and, you know, it's just an emotional problem alone. And Dick Cavett's piece makes it pretty clear. This is, I'm sure there are some cases that way, but the great preponderance come to people, he said, in all walks of life, all ages, all income groups, all occupations. And the biggest hurdle we have is having that people believe that it's an actual illness. So I think it's unfortunate that you focused on Paxil. I wish you would focus on other drugs that aren't in the, don't involve mental illness, because the mentally ill already have huge obstacles in achieving and attaining proper treatment.
Joyce, thanks very much for your call. And I know, Allison, your intent has never been to say that mental illness is not a real problem that needs treatment.
That's absolutely right. I mean, mental illness is, of course, a real medical issue, and it needs parity in treatment. And in fact, when I was a mental health reporter for the Boston Globe, I wrote a lot about the stigma of mental illness and how much it needs to be erased and how important it is for people with mental illness be taken seriously, that it is a medical illness. And that is not what I'm saying in the book at all. I mean, in fact, in my very first chapter, I make it very clear that these antidepressants do help many people. The problem is that the drug companies withheld information about their side effects and also about their effectiveness from doctors and consumers. And that is unethical, and that's what needs to be brought to the public's attention.
What about sort of self-governing practices within the medical profession? Clearly, this would violate the Hippocratic Oath for doctors to know about harmful effects and sort of let that go by the wayside.
Well, basically, I think what the problem is that doctors and medical researchers are allowed to get paid lots of money from drug companies in speaking and consulting fees, and those conflicts are not disclosed. They're not disclosed at all or they're not disclosed fully, and I think that medical centers need to do a better job of ensuring that doctors who are going to study particular drugs are not also getting paid thousands of dollars by the drug companies who are making those drugs. I mean, that's a blatant conflict of interest, and it should simply be prohibited. Medical journals do require doctors to disclose financial ties to drug companies, or at least the leading medical journals do. But again, they don't have to disclose how much they are making. So there's a difference between getting $10,000 a year from a drug company and getting $100,000 a year. It really does impact their judgment and make them biased.
Surely we know that there are dedicated and honorable medical researchers out there. And I'm wondering if you think, though, that this problem is sort of widely scattered. Is it something that is unique to the mental health drug segment, or is this something that is probably happening everywhere?
Unfortunately, I think it's very widespread. And you have only to look at Vioxx, which was a painkiller. And researchers, it's well documented that the researchers who submitted a draft of their first significant study to the New England Journal of Medicine, withheld the information that Vioxx increased the risk of heart attacks in some patients. And that's why Merck, 4 years later, ended up taking Vioxx off the market. But the researchers withheld that information, and it's very hard for the editors of the New England Journal of Medicine, to which it had been submitted, to know if it's not in the study that's submitted. And this is happening, like I said, again and again with other drugs, anti-cholesterol drugs like Viturin and Lipitor, anti-anemia drugs like Procrit and Aranesp, anti-diabetic drugs, Avandia. Again and again, this information about side effects and efficacy are not being fully disclosed.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Joyce in Plano. Hi, Joyce.
Hi. Well, my question relates similarly. My question was, why are the pharmaceutical companies not required by someone to reveal this information? And the other thing is that the general public has no ability to read the medical journals to learn to get this information.
So that's absolutely right. Basically, because of the New York State Attorney General's lawsuit, which I write about, and the heroines who came forward to speak the truth in my book, just last year, Congress passed a law requiring all drug companies to post the results of all of their findings of clinical trials, negative as well as positive, on a publicly available website. So that's a very important first step. But the problem is, as you allude to, it's very difficult for lay people, as well as doctors, to go to this website and read through the morass of data there to figure out what it means. So it remains a fact that the FDA should be posting this in a very understandable, readable, and legible manner on their websites, and this kind of information should be published in medical journals, not just the positive findings, but the negative findings as well, and it's currently not being done.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. The email address is think@kera.org. Let's go next to Julie in Dallas. Hi, Julie.
Hi. Well, you've already touched on my question a little bit. I had a question about the linkage between the doctors who were doing the research and the funding that they received from the pharmaceutical companies, and how much pressure that puts on them to report what the pharmaceutical companies want to hear.
Well, that's a very good question, because the research shows that doctors who have these financial ties and are getting money and personal income from drug companies are 10 to 20 times less likely to publish negative findings than those without the financial ties. So it really does affect their behavior, and it shouldn't be allowed. You're right.
Is it are doctors pressuring each other not to take this kind of money?
Well, there have been some strides in that area. In fact, in Massachusetts, a bill was filed in the state legislature to ban free gifts and lunches. Because, I mean, the drug companies try to influence doctors' judgment in many ways. Not only are they influencing the medical researchers themselves, the key opinion leaders, with direct money, but they also, you know, they give, when they're trying to sell a particular drug to doctors, they give them free lunches, they take them out for dinners, they give them free samples. So there's a lot of this benefits that do sway doctors' judgment. And the bill in Massachusetts would prohibit that kind of outlay by drug companies. And unfortunately, it's running into difficulty because the doctors don't want these free bennies to go away. And even the caterers who do these free lunches aren't happy with the bill. But so it's very hard to get changes made.
We have an email from Alan in Plano who writes, please keep in mind that from the clinician's perspective, this is commonplace medical knowledge. All of us know what your guest has said, and we share this information with each patient. What is critical to keep in mind is that there has been an 18% drop in prescriptions in the last 2 years because of the black box warnings, and an increase of 20% in completed suicides in adolescents. There are black box warnings throughout medicine, and this is why a careful exam needs to be done and patients need to be carefully followed.
Actually, that's not true. There's no, okay, what he's trying to say is that because of the decrease in the subscription rates of these antidepressants for children and adolescents, that there's been a corresponding increase in the suicidal rates, and that's simply not true. The New York Times and other medical journals have written articles about this showing that there is no correlation between the two, because the CDC data, it's based on 2004 CDC data, and the black box warnings didn't take effect until the end of 2004. There was a slight drop in suicide rates for 2004, but that was before the black box warnings went into effect. And the CDC suicide rates for 2005 are not yet available, so no one can really tell what the correlation is. So his email's a little misleading.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Rick in Frisco. Hi, Rick.
Hi. I was curious if she had data regarding non-SSRIs. I had depression a few years ago, and my physician originally prescribed Prozac, and it really didn't do anything for me. And then when she changed me to Wellbutrin, I had a great benefit. And I know a lot of times when they prescribe these drugs, you know, there's no medical scanner where they can say this is exactly what's going on, so they give you something and see how it works. Are there the same sort of research issues with the whole breadth of drugs, or is it the SSRIs in particular?
Well, Wellbutrin also has the black box warnings about the increase in suicidal thoughts and behaviors in some people. Fortunately for you, you didn't have that side effect, and that's great. But the black box warnings are on all antidepressants, not just the SSRIs. As to what happened with the scientific data, whether there was a misrepresentation of data with regard to Wellbutrin. Thank you. I can't say, because I didn't examine that, but I do have documents showing that there was that the researchers doing the study on Paxil did misrepresent the data. They withheld information about teenagers who tried to kill themselves from the final study. And in fact, the GlaxoSmithKline is currently being investigated by the United States Department of Justice for the misrepresentation of data and some of its marketing of Paxil.
My guest is journalist Allison Bass. Her new book is called Side Effects, A Prosecutor, A Whistleblower, and a Best-Selling Antidepressant on Trial. You can join us after the break by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, a way to keep your greatest two tools, imagination and curiosity, sharp.
You are listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with the author of Side Effects, A Prosecutor, A Whistleblower, and a Best-Selling Antidepressant on Trial. Her name is Allison Bass. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372. An email to think@kera.org from Stacy asks, do doctors get paid by drug companies for prescribing certain drugs?
Yeah, actually they do. In the case of Procrit and Aranesp, doctors were given millions of dollars in rebates to prescribe their drugs, and that they got more money if they prescribed their drugs exclusively. And they also, like I said before, get those doing research get thousands of dollars to in personal speaking and consulting fees by the drug companies who make the drugs they're touting. So, yes, there's a lot of that going on.
And even in cases where it doesn't happen so directly, I know that there is a code sort of so that drug companies can at least track how much of their product that each particular doctor is prescribing.
That's right. That is collected by the pharmacy, and the pharmacy sells that to the drug company, so they are able to tell what doctors are prescribing and how much of what they're prescribing. Absolutely.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next to Dwayne in Garland. Hi, Dwayne.
Hi. At what point do we become culpable in our own treatment? I mean, there are plenty of tests that will tell for brain chemistry, epinephrine levels, norepinephrine, serotonin. If a doctor doesn't do some of these tests but just says, hey, I've got a drug that may or may not work, I mean, isn't that kind of silly just to go off of that?
Well, first of all, the tests showing levels of different neurotransmitters, it's not really that effective either, I mean, because it's a lot more complicated. In other words, the original theory for the SSRI antidepressants were that they only acted on the serotonin system of the brain. So therefore, if you take these antidepressants, which boost serotonin levels around the cells, the synapses of the brain, then that would help depression. But it's not that simple. It turns out that these neurotransmitters are very interconnected. So you affect the serotonin system, and it affects other systems, neurotransmitter systems of the brain. So doing those tests, I don't think are that effective. I mean, I think that doctors or psychiatrists take a long medical history, and they can determine if someone is clinically depressed, fits the category of being clinically depressed, and that they can tell from a long medical history and knowledge of the patient. And at that point, and if they feel that other types of treatment haven't worked, like psychotherapy, cognitive behavior therapy, then they can start trying to prescribe drugs, the antidepressants. And the question is, and then the issue becomes that they need to monitor patients and make them aware of the side effects so that if there are bad side effects, they take them off the drug and try something else.
Well, and I guess another problem with getting the dose correct is that in some ways, an illness like depression is much like physical pain in that two people might have similar conditions and one person really perceives a far greater amount of depression than the next person might. It's equally real, but different sensations.
Exactly. It's a very complicated thing. And so the standard treatment used to be that if someone didn't respond to a drug in a couple of weeks, then they would up the dosage. But often, in some people, that would make the side effects worse. So brain chemistry is a very tricky thing. We're all incredibly different individuals, and what might work at 10 milligrams for one person doesn't, and they need to do 20 milligrams. The important thing to keep in mind is that doctors need to know and to communicate to their patients what possible side effects might occur so that they're on the lookout for these side effects.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Elizabeth in Mesquite. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi. Thank you for taking the call.
Sure.
I just had a comment. I was concerned about balance in the presentation, especially where the SSRIs are concerned. I think the SSRIs have been around for a long time and that they have a good history of effectiveness. And when there are comments made like referring to them as a quick fix, I just don't think that's helpful. And I know the guest did say that tests say that these drugs have been shown effective in adults, but then immediately qualified that comment by saying the tests have been called into question. And I think that casts doubt on the medications and also on the doctors that are prescribing it. That really isn't helpful because the people who need these drugs are really need to have confidence and be able to get the help when they need it. And so I think the efforts should be continuously made to keep this in context, that there is a problem out there, but it's not the case that people should be not trusting their doctors and refusing to take the medications that their doctors are prescribing. And that's just a concern.
Yeah, thanks for your call, Elizabeth. Let's get a response from Allison. Thanks.
Well, sure. I mean, I think that consumers have to be beware, and they have to know if their doctors are taking a lot of money from the drug companies whose drugs they are prescribing. So I would support, for instance, a national registry. This is something that Senator Chuck Grassley of Iowa has introduced a bill that would require a national registry so that all doctors who are receiving money from drug companies, it goes on this national registry. And that way consumers know, okay, well, my doctor isn't taking any money or isn't taking thousands of dollars from drug companies, and therefore I can trust him. But, oh, this doctor is doing that, and therefore I cannot trust him. So I think consumers need more information because they simply can't blindly trust doctors, and that's a sad fact.
Surely you do hear from honest, sort of very professional physicians who say, I absolutely believe that these drugs are effective and I want to continue prescribing them.
Absolutely, and they should be able to continue prescribing them. I am not at all espousing that these drugs not be prescribed, particularly in adults over the age of 25, because they have been proven in clinical trials to work. I am merely saying that people need to know what the negative side effects are, and doctors need to monitor their patients closely. And this information must not be withheld by the drug companies. That's what I'm saying.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to David in Louisville. Hi, David.
Hi. I would just like to make a comment. I'm a physician. I also have a unique perspective because my wife is a pharmaceutical rep. So I think I have a unique perspective, and I want to make it clear, while several of the points your guests are very accurate, you know, don't give patients, the general public, the wrong impression that when they go see their family doctor or they go see their general surgeon or whomever, that they're on the take for thousands of dollars from drug companies for prescribing. That doesn't happen. Maybe it does in the few drugs that she mentioned, but in general, that's not happening at all. In fact, the pharma guidelines that are out that limit what pharmaceutical reps can do and those sorts of things severely restrict what they can do. So unless I'm going to change my prescribing habits because somebody brings me bagels for breakfast, that's just not going to happen. And so I just want to make it clear that, you know, most physicians are doing the right thing, and that there may be a few instances where doctors are paid for speaking engagements and doing work, but we're not getting paid thousands and thousands of dollars, as she's mentioned several times, to prescribe drugs. And I'll get off the phone and take your comments off the air. I appreciate it.
Thanks for your call, David.
Well, unfortunately, a lot of doctors are getting paid in speaking and consulting fees from the drug companies, and this needs to be publicly known, and the amounts need to be made publicly available to consumers so they know whether they can trust their doctors. In addition, I would disagree with the respectfully disagree with the caller that free bagels and free dinners at fancy restaurants do sway prescribing judgment, and they shouldn't be allowed. Drug sales reps should not be allowed to give free bagels, free lunches, free dinners to doctors in an effort to get them to prescribe their drugs, because it does, unfortunately, sway people's judgment.
With conditions as they exist today, what do you recommend to patients who want to know this information? It's already, for so many people, such a daunting experience to walk into a doctor's office, this authority figure, and ask her, well, do you get money for this? That's a challenging proposition for some people.
Oh, I absolutely agree, and that's why I'm all in support of a national registry that is available to consumers so they can see what their doctors make from drug companies.
But before that exists, what do you say
before that
to people?
Exists, they should be going to the FDA website, www.fda.gov, and looking up the drug that their doctor has prescribed to see what the black box warning, if there are black box warnings on them, and to see what they are. Elderly father was prescribed Procrit, which was an anti-anemia drug, and he was prescribed a very high dosage of it, even though there were black box warnings by the FDA that it increased the risk of heart attacks in some people. And his doctors didn't tell him about that, and 5 days after he started the Procrit injection, he did get a mild heart attack. Now, whether there was a correlation, we have no way of knowing, but the point is that the doctor should have made him aware that the FDA had put black box warnings on this drug. So it's very difficult for consumers to know about this because some doctors don't tell them about the side effects, and they trust their doctors. And so what they should do is go to the FDA website to see what the FDA says about the drug they've been prescribed.
Allison Bass's book is called Side Effects. Let's go next to Chris in McKinney. Hi, Chris.
Hi, how are you? I appreciate you taking my
sure.
call. My wife is also a former sales rep for a big company, and it was amazing and astounding to me, actually, the amount of money spent on marketing for these doctors and physicians, not only the free lunches and free meals, but dinners out, vacations. It was amazing to me how much was spent. But aside from that, my question was the amount of money spent on direct advertising, TV commercials, radio commercials. I mean, how do you think that affects this analysis?
That's a very good question because it does affect it tremendously. I did an op-ed piece recently for the Boston Globe about direct-to-consumer advertising, and the United States is only one of two developed countries in the world that is allowed to do, where drug companies are allowed to do direct-to-consumer advertising, and a lot of that advertising, research has shown, is very misleading. The side effects are not explained as carefully as they should be, or they're that the portion that has the side effects in them is sped up, or there's music or visuals that divert people's attention when the side effects are talked about. So this puts enormous pressure on doctors. When consumers see this advertising, they go in and say, I want that drug. It turns out that the drug is not what they really may want, and that there are side effects that they don't know about. But the doctors feel pressured to prescribe it because the patient has come in and said, well, if you don't do it, I'll go to another doctor. So I think that that does, as you say, contribute to the problem.
Let's go next to Robert in Dallas. Hello, Robert.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I know we're talking about mental health, but I'm actually a 10-year HIV-positive individual, and it's been neat to watch my treatment over 10 years as a microcosm of healthcare in general. One thing I'd like your guests to talk on is about just the cost of drugs. I mean, I very happily pay for my medication. It keeps me alive. But in the back of my mind, I'm hoping the thousands of dollars a month are going to fuel and fund further research for my drugs or drugs for diabetes or what have you. Can you talk about that, or is a lot of that money just more profit-taking at this point?
Well, I could talk a little bit about it. You're absolutely right that because there are very few restrictions on what drug companies can charge, in the United States they charge far more for prescription drugs than they do in Canada and in Europe and in other countries. And if you just look at the Plan B Medicare bill that was passed a few years ago, because of the strength of the drug companies' lobbying and campaign contributions in Washington, they were able to get a provision put in that bill that said that the Medicare was not allowed to negotiate with them on the cost of prescription drugs. And that should never have passed. That's just patently absurd, because that means that the federal government itself can't negotiate with drug companies on the cost of these very, very important drugs.
Allison, are you a different sort of patient now when you have occasion to visit a doctor than you were before you were covering this story?
Well, I would say so. I mean, as a reporter for the Boston Globe, I mean, I always, when you're reporting, you ask a lot of dumb questions. That's what you do. You ask questions. And so I've always asked questions of my doctors. And I do have very good doctors. And fortunately, I have a primary care doctor who is very clear about explaining side effects.
And the last takeaway, again, we talked a little bit about going to the FDA website and all that. It sounds like basically you don't want any patient for any reason to just automatically accept anything they're told.
I think that patients need to be aware. I think they need to be informed. Unless they have a very long relationship with their doctor, whom they trust because of past experience that the doctor is very good at explaining side effects and explaining the ramifications of a treatment, if they have that kind of relationship with their doctor, then they're fine. But if they're starting out with a new doctor or they have questions, then they should definitely make themselves informed.
Allison Bass's book is called Side Effects, A Prosecutor, A Whistleblower, and a Best-Selling Antidepressant on Trial. Allison, thank you so much for joining us.
It was a pleasure being here.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.